This WGAN podcast is brought to you by New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland for your acute rehabilitation needs. Hope is here.
11:35 here at News Radio 560 WGAN. I am pleased to welcome to Inside Maine Daniel Pipes. Daniel is a historian, a writer, a political commentator. He writes a column twice weekly, published in places like National Review. He's the president of the Middle East Forum and publisher of Middle East Quarterly Journal, and spent some time living in the Middle East, studying it all his life. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us here on Inside Maine.
My pleasure, Arthur.
So, Iraq is a mess right now, and to my untrained eye, this looks primarily like a conflict between the Sunni and Shia branches of Islam, militant factions thereof, at least on the Sunni side. Can you give folks a little bit of understanding of what that divide is all about and how long it's been going on?
Well, the divide goes back to the very origins of Islam in the 7th century and concerned at the beginning who should be the leader of the Muslim community, the best Muslim or the closest relative of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. And over 1,400 years, this has become a very deeply entrenched difference. The Shiite base is Iran, and Sunnis predominate. And in the Levant, in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, the differences between the two sides are intense, and particularly have gotten more so since Ayatollah Khomeini took over in Iran in 1979. This has been building and building. And in Syria, we've seen fighting for some years now, 3 years, between Sunnis and Shiis. And in Iraq, it's been a low-grade war, but suddenly, as of a week ago, it is a full-scale war. We, I think, on the outside, are not really party to this. We can't fix it. We can't resolve it. We should stay out of it.
I'm speaking with Daniel Pipes. He's a historian, a multiply published writer, studies the Middle East for the Middle East Quarterly Journal, and is president of the Middle East Forum. Now, in Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, that was a Sunni-led majority, correct?
It was a Sunni-led minority. In other words, the Arab Sunnis of Iraq are about 20-25%.
Okay.
But they historically, until the U.S. intervention in 2003, had dominated the country for many centuries. And he was a Sunni, and he represented Sunni interests.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, since our intervention in 2003, the Shiites have taken over. They are the majority.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the Kurds, who are Sunni, but who are ethnically different, have created their own effectively autonomous state in the north of the country. So there are three populations in Syria, in Iraq: the Kurdish Sunnis, the Arab Sunnis, and the Arab Shiites.
How do the Kurdish Sunnis and the Arab Sunnis get along, or do the Kurds just want to be left by themselves?
The latter. They want to be left by themselves. They want to have their own state. They want to have their own revenues, and they have actually in the last 20 years in northern Iraq done a very impressive job. Universities, commerce, stability—it's been impressive compared to either the Sunni Arab or Shiite Arab political careers.
I'm speaking with Daniel Pipes. He's a historian, writer, political commentator. Now, I'm not taking calls in this segment, but if you have a question for Daniel, you could send it to me by email, Arthur@560WGAN.com. That's Arthur@560WGAN.com. So, as you said, the conflict between the Sunni and Shia groups in Iraq has been sort of at a low boil ever since the U.S. intervention there. What is triggering what's going on right now?
When the U.S. forces left Iraq at the very end of 2011, this created an opportunity for the rulers of the country,
those
who are
Shiite, yep,
right, to really push, and they did. And the Sunni backlash has been fairly intense.
Well, let me stop and ask you a question there. You said they were really pushing. I mean, why were they pushing? Why weren't they working for some degree of national unity?
The Shiites have historically felt, and with justice, that they have been discriminated against, that they're disadvantaged. And with the American departure 3 years ago, finally they had an opportunity to really run the place, and that's what they started to do.
Some payback.
Yeah,
okay.
Under the prime ministership of Nouri al-Maliki. So, and he, at the same time, or Iraq at the same time, has been falling increasingly under the influence of Iran, the great Shiite power. And so the Iranians are quite happy with how things have been developing, pushing and pushing and getting more and more control over the country, pushing the Sunnis out, leaving the Kurds basically to themselves in the north. But now we have this reaction, this very intense reaction, this extreme Islamist Sunni jihadi reaction. And the Iranians are faced with this now. They have to protect themselves. They have to protect Baghdad. I think they will. And I think there will be a battle in Iraq somewhat similar to the battle that has been taking place for 3 years in Syria, where you have Turkish-supported Sunni extremist Islamists fighting against a central government backed, that's Shiite in orientation, and backed by the Iranian government. And so what you have in effect are jihadis who are Sunni fighting jihadis who are Shiite. I, who abominate all jihadis, am quite happy to have them fight each other. The problem is that there's a tremendous humanitarian price for this, whether it be in Syria or Iraq. And so I think our effort should be to help those who are harmed by this, but we should not get in the way of the Sunni jihadis fighting the Shiite jihadis. Let them go at each other.
I'm speaking with Daniel. I'm speaking with Daniel Pipes. He's a historian and writer. Now, the Sunni charge, if you will, is being led by a group called ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, sometimes called ISIL for Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. But that is an Al-Qaeda-inspired group, if not directly linked, correct?
Exactly. They had their differences with Al-Qaeda itself and went their own way, but Al-Qaeda-inspired is a good way of putting it. Their ideas are very similar. Other goals are the same.
How big a group is it, or do we even know?
It's estimated to have some 2,000-3,000 fighters.
That's fairly small.
Yeah. And the Iraqi governmental forces, armed and trained by Americans in the Mosul area, are estimated at 78,000.
So how come they're getting their butts kicked?
Because, on the one hand, the ISIS fighters are very determined, mm-hmm. and on the other hand, the Iraqi government fighters are slothful and corrupt. It's an old story in the Middle East that government troops tend to be really good at repressing their own people, but not very good at fighting wars.
Yeah, yeah. Out of curiosity, the Iraq government troops, are how many of them are Sunni and how many of them are Shia?
They tend to be Shiite overall.
Okay. Right.
The Sunnis have less and less interest in being part of the governmental apparatus.
Now, during the before the surge after the U.S. action in Iraq, lots of Sunnis were joining militant groups or aligning with militant groups, basically because, well, among other things, it was a job. And I think there was probably some concern about Shia domination. How much of the fighting that's currently going on in Iraq is just rank and file Sunnis joining forces with the ISIS?
So far, that does not seem to be a very large component.
Okay.
The ISIS forces are trained, are devoted to their leadership, and are effective. I think it's hard for stray Sunni Iraqis to become part of this apparatus. But with time, especially since with the seizure of Mosul, ISIS apparently got almost $500 million worth of gold. So they're now rolling in money. And, of course, they got lots of arms, too, our arms, the arms we provided, are now in ISIS hands. So one can look forward to a substantial growth in the troops available to ISIS.
Mm-hmm. Where will those troops come from? Will they have to train them, or how's that going to work?
Well, in part, they're foreigners. They're from all over the world, including the United States. But mostly they will be Iraqis. That's the natural recruiting ground. Sunnis of Iraq. Sunni Arabic speakers of Iraq.
Is there any precedent for a Sunni-Shia battle over a nation-state quite like this in history?
Well, we're seeing it in Syria at this moment.
Okay.
So there's that immediate precedent. But there are others as well. For example, in Yemen, far away at the southern, southwestern tip of the Arabian Peninsula, the population is divided between Sunnis and Shiis, and they have been contending for power for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
In Iran, it used to be a Sunni state. The Shiites took over some centuries ago. So in Lebanon, there are conflicts between them. So it's not that unusual. But the most exact parallel is in Syria, where it really is quite close.
Hmm. Yeah, and quite messy. And that's what we have to look forward to in Iraq.
I think so. And I think what we're seeing in the background of all this is Turkey, the great Sunni power, historically and emerging at present, and Iran, the great Shiite power, historically and at present. They are contending for domination of the Muslim world. And I think we have round one in Syria and round two in Iraq, and there might be further ones in the future. You know, we've been paying attention over recent years, primarily to Arabic speakers, Saudis, Egyptians, so forth. But I think the real powers, and also we paid attention a great deal, say John Kerry did, to the Arab-Israeli conflict. But the real important developments now are such as we're seeing today in Iraq, this contention between Turkey and Iran.
So Turkey is really pulling the strings for the Sunni side? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
You are hearing me say that, yeah. The Sunni side is getting its money, its arms, its medical care, its food from Turkey.
Well, what
look
about
at the map.
Where's Saudi Arabia in that equation?
The Saudis did in the beginning, and other Gulf Arabs as well, did provide money and arms, but they became wary of what's taking place. They're scared of this, and they've pretty much stopped, from what one can tell. And even when they did give, they gave it to Turkey. Turkey is, if you look at the map, where ISIS is now dominant in both Syria and Iraq, is more or less contiguous with Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting their provisions, and they're getting their R&R, and everything is coming from Turkey. And the Turkish government is playing a double game here. On the one hand, saying ISIS is a terrorist organization, and just a week ago, had a presidential powwow between the presidents of Turkey and Iran. But on the other hand, it is supplying them with what they need to fight.
What leverage does does Europe and the United States have on Turkey in this thing because of Turkey's membership in NATO?
Very little. Turkey is a member of NATO and has been a member for over 60 years and was until recently a really very reliable member of NATO. But now it's gone off in its own direction, and not just in this way. For example, it has a major purchase in the process of going through with a Chinese firm. It has increasingly ties with Russia. So I would say that Turkey is no longer really a reliable NATO ally.
I'm speaking with Daniel Pipes. He's an historian, a columnist, an author. He runs the Middle East Quarterly Journal. What are the implications for Israel in all of this?
For Israel, so far it's been pretty good in that its opponents, adversaries, are fighting each other. But it could turn nasty at any point. For example, Al-Qaeda-related organization is close to it in the northeast of the country in the Golan Heights and also in the southwest of the country in Sinai. So what we're seeing overall is that tyranny, which was the byword of the Middle East, is being replaced by anarchy. And this is in some ways even more dangerous than tyranny. And for Israel at this point, anarchy means that it's being left alone, but that anarchy could come and bite it as well.
Would anything be different if the U.S. hadn't withdrawn from Iraq?
In the long term, no, in that we did not have the will to impose our way on the Iraqis. We spent a lot of money, we lost quite a few lives. But in the end, unlike Germany and Japan in 1945, where we had defeated a very powerful enemy and we were absolutely determined to change the nature of these countries, and we did with enormous success, in Iraq it took 3 weeks and we were, Iraq isn't really on our minds. We were not that interested. And so, yes, under President George W. Bush, we did invest a great deal, but it wasn't enough, never would have been enough. The Iraqis themselves didn't really accept our tutelage, and so sooner or later they would have ignored us, as they have done. And I believe that the whole vast American effort in terms of treasury and lives is just disappearing in the sands now. And within a matter of months or years, there'll be virtually no sign of it at all. This huge investment we made, it's really tragic.
Is the same thing going to happen in Afghanistan?
Absolutely, same thing.
No two ways about it.
No two ways about it.
So
it's very much in process.
Where does this all end?
Well, the Middle East is going through a catharsis. This is a region that has had enormous difficulty in coming to terms with modern life. And it is... There was a period from about 1970 to 2010 when not much happened. The tyrants dominated, and that was that. But in the last few years, since the Arab upheavals began in late 2010, it's been very fast-moving, for example, in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, Syria, Iraq. And I can't tell you where it's going to end, but I do think this is a necessary process through which the Middle Eastern states must go through in order to advance. It's very difficult, very unpleasant, very tragic in many cases, but I don't see an alternative to it. And so to return, I don't think there's much we can do. And George W. Bush's efforts have shown that. They just got nowhere. They did nothing. So we should protect our own interests, watch it warily, help where we can be helpful, especially on a humanitarian level, but stay out of the fighting.
We've got to leave it there. Daniel Pipes, thanks so much for joining us here on Inside
Man. My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Daniel Pipes. He is a historian, a columnist, a author, and runs the Middle East Quarterly Journal. Not a cheerful conversation, but a pretty informed look at what may be happening in the Middle East. We'll be back right after this.